Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations and joins us for the weekly update. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Oh, good morning after an uneventful week.
Yeah, I'll tell you, there's some people out there who really make my job very easy. Among them, the President of the United States. And I'll ask the question that so many listeners have demanded that I ask over the last, 12 to 18 hours. So many listeners have asked me if I could please pose the first question the following way to you. Mr. Honlein, why did the President of the United States, in fact, take the outrageous step yesterday of forcing Israel to use the 1967 borders as the starting point for negotiations?
Well, I'm not sure that he put it in that context of the starting point, but that is the concern, is that, in fact, once you lay it out, that they, as they call it, pocket it and say, okay, we now start from that point where we negotiate from the 67 borders with, quote, land swaps. This is a new position. This has not been traditional U.S. policy, as some people have tried to say, and there have been a number of very interesting articles written about it over the last, 12 or 15 hours since the 20 hours since the speech was made. I think we have to look at what the president did and why he did it. When the question came up about why did he give it now, maybe it is because Netanyahu was coming, but he wanted to give a speech on the Middle East. I think it was a mistake to put the two issues together. Mm-hmm. I think he should have given the speech about the new Arab Spring, about the American relevance, because all of that has been lost in the aftermath of his comments about the Israeli-Palestinian issue. So for the purpose that he enunciated, that was not achieved, and he eclipsed it by bringing up the issues related to the Palestinian-Israeli, which was about 20%, I think, of the speech. And then the issues that were specifically raised and that people have been discussing, one is most people don't know what the 67 lines mean, mm-hmm. what this is a reference to. And I've had a lot of interviews where the interviewer would say, well, could you just explain to us what does it mean, 67 lines? Mm. What happened? And people don't know. We assume everybody knows.
Right.
In fact, the 67 lines are the 49 armistice lines. There was nothing sacred about 1967 until the war came, right? It was the same as 1966 and 1956. So the question was why he created this new paradigm or apparent new paradigm for U.S. engagement when he was doing this speech about the Middle East. And one of the points that they keep making is that this is the same thing that Bush said and that Clinton said, when that is not correct. With the Clinton parameters, which the president withdrew when he left office, didn't say 67 borders. It did say swaps and other territorial mm-hmm. arrangements. Mm-hmm. And I think that why this is perceived as a major shift is that it goes away from the policy based on 242, which, if you remember, doesn't say from the territories, meaning that Israel would have to withdraw from all the lands. It
right.
says territory.
Right.
And that was darshaned and
right.
studied and super studied, and they had every Gemara commentary on it. But that was definitely the intent, was that people saw the 67 borders as not defensible. And when they said secure and recognized, it was not necessarily synonymous with pre-67 borders. And land swaps was meant to resolve the issues at the end that were outstanding, not to be the fundamental of the relationship. And then you have putting the key issues, refugees and Jerusalem, as to be discussed after you do borders. Well, once they get the borders, why would they then come and they'll say, okay, you want to resolve this, you know, give us what we want?
Well, I was thinking that the Jerusalem issue is resolved. We're going to 67. Everyone knows what that means.
Well, that was the implication, is that
right.
67 borders doesn't apply necessarily to Jerusalem. But as you know, the 67 borders in Jerusalem are not tenable. There's no way you could implement it today. And I guess it would come under the category of another one of the land swaps.
Right.
But on the refugee issue, what was missing, I think, was the fact that there was the one sentence that says, but not in Israel. That if you want to make the refugees an issue, and they wanted a balance that say, you got Jerusalem, you got refugees, these are emotive issues, but always when the refugee issue was made clear that the solution does not lie in Israel.
Meaning the right of return issue.
The right of return, right. Where there's no right and there's no return. But when you just put the two issues out there to be discussed after the borders issue, so you've already set it up for this for negotiations to fail, because they're not going to come to conclusion, and then the whole international community is going to come down to Israel and say, oh, just for Jerusalem and just for this, you're not going to let the peace thing go through, rather than saying you resolve all these issues that and we didn't see anywhere where it said an end of claims or an end of conflict in all its manifestations, that this has to be one of the conditions for negotiations, that you're not going to have a year later, right. Like in Gaza, like in Lebanon, that once you withdraw, then they come up with new demands and new complications.
I need you to discuss the timing for a moment, and really an overview, because, I mean, specifically, you know, how many of us, I mean, you better than anybody knows what goes on at the White House, but again, you know, how much any of us really know about the background of all this, but the timing, the fact that the prime minister was practically in the air to Washington already, the fact that we know what happened a year ago, the fact that even before what happened a year ago, the president slighted the prime minister, whether, you know, it was intentional or not. The fact that AIPAC and the conference that the president of the United States agreed to attend is starting in a couple of days. Explain this timing overview to me.
Well, I'm not 100% sure. I don't know. I've talked to people in the administration. They said they wanted to do this speech for a long time. He's leaving on a trip. He had not been scheduled to speak to AIPAC until very recently. There have been discussions about it. There were discussions of other people from the administration coming, not him, and not he. So I think this was really a rather late development in terms of you know, him being there. Second, I think that they had intended to do a speech on the Middle East, but I'm not sure they intended it to be on the Arab-Israeli issue. One of the lessons we learned is that the Arab-Israeli issue is not the key to the problems in the Middle East.
Right.
You know, from when the administration came into office, if you remember, they kept saying this is the central issue.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw the evolution over time that they came to realize that was not the issue. I mean, Iran is much more of the central issue. And if you saw the demonstrations, it's food, it's economy, it's jobs. It's not the Arab-Israeli conflict. So the choice of the timing is a little bit hard to understand. And maybe because he's going to give a speech, and, you know, I tell people we've got to hold back judgment a little bit until we hear what happens today with the meeting between Netanyahu and the president.
By the way, you know, last time an episode like this occurred, and again, I'm referring back to mid-2010, I believe within 24 hours the president had some type of retraction or clarification. Remember that? Is there going to be a clarification today, you think, because of all this outrage, or there's not as much outrage as I think there is?
Well, there is a mixed reaction in Israel. Obviously, there are those who you know, ideologically support, and there were many good points in the speech. We can't say that it was all one-sided. I mean, there were things that Israel wanted and Israel has looked for. But
yeah, but they're so overshadowed by this.
I was just going to say, but it is all overshadowed by what they had to know was going to be the central line and what would be picked up, and, you know, with the prime minister winging his way over at the time that it's you know, that it was released, and he issued a statement that was
right.
And now you already have recriminations.
Yeah, about the language he used, right.
Pardon me?
About the language he used.
About the language he used. And there have been...
Will there be a clarification right. today? Do you think the White
House... I think there will be at the press conference that's going to follow the meeting. And that's why I'm saying that we have to hold off a little bit and see what they say there, and also what the president is going to say Sunday morning in his speech to AIPAC. It'll be interesting to see the reaction of the audience. I hope it'll be respectful, but, you know, it's the president, but it'll be interesting to see what the reaction will be. There are 12,000 people coming to the AIPAC conference, and
what percentage of those 12,000 do we figure might agree with what the president said yesterday? There's probably a significant number, right?
There's always a significant number, and there's some who will say, look, we agree with part of it, we don't agree with
but
this.
The boos usually outweigh the applause anyway. That's true.
As a courtesy, yes.
Yeah, that's what usually happens. So even if 10% don't like what he said, it's very possible they'll be heard very well.
That he will be heard, right.
Well, that they'll be heard well, that they will, you know, make an impact, and that'll make the headlines, you know, that they that he wasn't treated properly. But I guess
the other question, just one other point on your question about the timing. What is strange about the timing is that it comes after Fatah and Hamas announced this reconciliation.
Good point.
And, you know, to do it now and not to demand of Hamas, he said it raises profound and legitimate questions for Israel, but he doesn't say that the United States policy is going to shift because of it and not give or appear to give a reward after this merger with a terrorist organization and the Fatah itself engaging in a lot of very strange and unacceptable behavior, including now they're going to announce that the PA has been paying the terrorists in Israeli jails a monthly salary all the time they're there, you know, as money allows. So it's a good argument why we should not be giving them any money, aside from the fact that Hamas is part of the government. You know, what is likely is the Palestinians will simply take up the call and say, okay, let's negotiate based on what the president said, you know, with the 67 lines, with the mutual swaps, which means that you're not just taking land. When you're talking about mutual swaps, you're taking about land from Israel from pre-67.
Right.
And, you know, the swaps idea, which was meant only as a mechanism to adjust, it wasn't meant to be the fundamental approach to this. The idea that Israel should get defensible borders. Everyone agreed 67 lines, not defensible borders. Israel has moved on that position to and Netanyahu did it again in his speech last week about concessions they already make, you know, adjustments to it. But never did anybody say we would give up the idea of defensible borders as a fundamental commitment.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning Radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope. Around the world on the web, jmnam.org. A couple of listeners pointed out also in regard to the land issue. The President of the United States said, how could the President of the United States use the term, in terms of a Palestinian state, use the term contiguous state which borders Israel, Jordan, and Egypt. Isn't that logistically not possible?
No. Well, Egypt, by virtue of Gaza.
Contiguous?
Well, contiguous meaning in primarily West Bank, where they're saying, you know, that this has always been a demand of the Arabs. And contiguous, there's, you know, there was the discussion of having an overland route that would go from...
That would connect Gaza with the West Bank.
The West Bank,
right.
But that land for that route would come out of the swap.
Right.
In other words, if you're giving that land for them to use to commute back and forth, and there was talk about the tunnel, there was talk about a bridge, there was talk about other ways that, you know, people couldn't just get off of it and terrorists or others come through, although it's hard to, I guess, to monitor that fully, but... There's been talk of all sorts of arrangements that would allow for that.
Who do you think, I don't know if you would conjecture on the air, but maybe you'll humor me, who was behind this? Who wrote the speech? Who is sitting next to the president's ear that went ahead and recommended these types of statements in this speech? Or do you think it was really a completely independent decision on his part?
I think the decision for the speech was his. I think he had a lot of input into it, but, you know, he has a team that around him, the National Security Advisors, the State Department, I think Hillary Clinton, and others had a lot of input into the speech.
In terms of his, I'm not talking now about, well, like Secretary of State is actually a member of the cabinet, so I guess that would take away that question. Also, the in terms of the desire to start up with Israel at this point. This was an article that I read this morning. What does it seem like? Does it seem like he's being courageous? Does it seem like he's being a bully? What is the perception of the President of the United States now that he has done this to our greatest ally in the Middle East?
For most people, there's no perception. They don't understand what the issues are. They don't know what the implications, why saying 67 with swaps, you know, what it means.
Most people don't even understand what it means, right?
And they have no clue what the borders mean. Mm-hmm. When you tell people the 67 borders mean Israel's 9 miles wide, they think you're nuts. And there are a lot of issues, you know, these intricacies are far beyond the general populace, even interested people don't really necessarily understand the nuance of the president saying, look, the refugee issue will be a final status issue along with Jerusalem. Why would they think about the fact that, you know, that's exactly how the Palestinians are going to sabotage it by putting, and or the fact that he didn't say they're not coming back to Israel.
Right.
You know, that the solution, that it could be, you could even say it's a final status issue, but based on the premise that they're not coming back. And you don't raise the hope. You don't indicate that this is a possibility.
Right. We publicized a rally that's taking place in New York today. I would assume you have no problem with anybody who feels the need to take to the street and have their voices heard on these issues.
As long as people do it in a responsible way, and again, I think waiting to hear what happens, to hear what the Prime Minister has to say, what the President has to say. We don't know if they'll back off, if they'll make additional definitions to what he said. And I think that you know, should be the one caveat. But I do think that people, if they're upset about what they heard or if they like what they heard, they should make their voices heard. They should, you know, speak about, write to the White House. You can make your voices heard to members of Congress. A lot of members of Congress have spoken up, including Democrats, who have come out and been critical of the speech or expressed deep concern about the speech. I don't know if you saw, you know, Eric Cantor, very strong.
We have Congressman Anthony Weiner, who's going to join us about a half hour from now. And this begs a question which, again, came to my mind yesterday. I've raised this probably, I don't know how many times in the last 20 years with you. Does it give you the feeling, again, that with all the support that we have and that Israel has in the Congress of the United States of America, because the president is essentially the most powerful man in the world, now it is almost irrelevant how much Congress is out there fighting on our behalf when the president goes ahead and makes statements like these?
No, it's not irrelevant at all. I think Congress is a safeguard. That's why we have the checks and balance system in the United States that enables and empowers Congress to do a lot. And you've seen it, whether it's on Iran, whether it's on other issues where they get ahead of the administration or often pull the administrations along. But your fundamental point is right, that the president still remains the president. He has a lot of authority, a lot of power. Even if it's only the bully pulpit, he has that. And that can make a big difference about what is the message. What is the message you project? And in the Middle East, I can tell you that it's an issue of great concern to the Arabs about the message he projects on Israel. They have raised it. Even this week, I met an Arab leader. I actually met several, and they raise it. And they don't understand. One of them said to me yesterday afternoon that he didn't understand, you know, the speech and why he created this issue rather than focusing on that, and that in the speech he did not talk about Iran and the Green Revolution in Iran or the Christians in Lebanon, and he did not raise a lot of the other issues. He does want to make America relevant again, and he knows that America's standing in the Middle East by every visitor who's come to see him and every Arab leader we meet or others meet, and most of them even say it publicly today. Talk about the fact that American influence because of the way we treated Mubarak or Bahrain or in Libya or whatever issue they raise. And I think the president's trying to reach out and address the issues of the Arab Spring was a valid thing to do.
I think
it was a mistake to mix this in there.
How much of that reaction from Arab leaders that you just described you got, how much of that is the feeling among them that, you know, Israel's in the end is the only one who's going to take care of the bad guys, so to speak? They're the only ones protecting this neighborhood. Is there a lot of that in there?
I'll tell you what one head of state said to us earlier this week, and he said he talked about the common problem and the reassessment that went on about Israel, that because of the common problem we have, Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And Iran has changed the balance.
And Iran is a lot larger than it used to be, if you know what I mean, with all its tentacles everywhere and controlling all these different governments.
That's right, and they must have taken, I would say, they looked at this speech and listened to it with enjoyment, because we didn't hear that their ally, their protege, Hamas, being held to the same standards that we have traditionally held them to. He said it, the president did say, and again, I want to say there were a lot of things in there about Israel's right to self-defense and about the criticizing the UDI, Unilateral Declaration of Independence, by the Palestinians, and other moves, and about Israel's security. which are all cited, especially in the Israeli press today, about the positives that are in the speech. But the problem is that no one will pay attention to that because of the overriding focus on the issues that are seen as very central. This one line carries so much baggage and significance that you know, for anybody who follows the Middle East closely, it will recognize it. But for the bulk of people, they won't.
Right. It's going to be cold in that White House today. Bring your winter coat. It's going to be a cold atmosphere between the president and the prime minister. There may be some photo ops today that we may regret, I'm telling you, unless the prime minister stays very calm and knows that this is a very significant meeting.
Well, he knows it's a very significant meeting for him and for them. But I think, you know, I saw one headline by a rather recognized analyst in Israel, Alef Ben, where he said that, you know, Obama granted Netanyahu a major diplomatic victory and said that, you know, he got 85% of what he wanted, including the fact that he said there can't be an imposed solution and it has to come from the parties. And
right.
The president did not say, you know, I'm going to call the parties together next week and start demanding that they implement. I mean, you did not have those things in the speech, which then emphasizes more, if you understand those things, then why would you make this reference?
There was zero timing in the speech, right? There was no discussion about any timetable. Am I right or wrong about that?
No timetables, no schedules, except the reference to the September
meeting. Oh, right. So now the president, it seemed, and I'm glad you brought this up, the president, it seemed, indicated that there would be a nothing gained by an effort in the United Nations to declare a Palestinian state. Was that significant in that we always feel that the United States may be the only one protecting Israel from it?
Yes, and it still is. And we've seen the Europeans waffling on this issue a great deal in recent weeks. Again, the move ahead on this unilateral declaration of independence, as they call it, I can tell you from sources in the United Nations, is moving, and that they have probably already a commitment from the majority, and it will be very hard to stop it. I mean, there's very little the United States can do, but they can take steps that will get the Palestinians to withdraw it. I mean, we have to, as many members of Congress have demanded, stop the aid. As long as Hamas is part of this, and Hamas is Hamas, which meaning they're forsworn to the destruction of Israel, don't forswear terrorism, don't do the other things that are required of them, which were not specified by the president, then we should be telling them, look, you're not getting any more aid. We're not going to assist you, and especially now that they say that they use aid to pay for all the terrorists who are sitting in jail and giving them monthly salaries. And money is fungible. It's not with Hamas in the government. We don't know how much of it goes to them and how much they benefit or be able to dictate how it's expended.
But there have been so many good reasons, in addition to the one you just mentioned, to suspend funding, and it never works. It never seems to be legitimate enough to actually go ahead and do the suspension.
That is a good point, because you're right. But part of the reasoning was that the money that we give goes, for one, for training the security forces, which Israel wants to see the Palestinians do, and so that they enforce and have the capacity to enforce the law on their side. And then the rest of the money goes to projects. We don't give money to the PA per se, but it's very hard to make that case when you look at what Abbas said, which is that we're ready to give up all the money from the United States
right.
just to have the shidduch with the with the Palestinians.
Right. With Hamas, you mean?
I'm sorry, with Hamas.
With Hamas. All right, a couple of other things. Obviously, this would have been a big week even without the speech, but obviously we have to focus on that. George Mitchell's resignation goes into effect today?
Well, it's actually been in effect for quite a while.
Does it matter?
Informal. Yeah, it doesn't matter. He's really not been playing a major role. He's gone there periodically, but I think he's been sidelined. This is something he intended to do for a while. You know, his age, he has kids, he wants
right.
to go back to his firm.
Also,
most of all, because he's not playing a central role in it.
Also, Malcolm, this was scary. And look, every terrorist attack is scary, and every bad piece of news from Israel, you know, scares everybody around the world. But this Nakba Day infiltration, riot, call it whatever you wish, and I'm not even referring now to some of the other episodes from this past Sunday. I'm referring specifically to the northern border and the riotous gangs coming in from Syria. What happened? Was Israel not prepared? Was the enemy better prepared and had been planning this for so long that it went, essentially the way they wanted it to? I mean, what went on there on Sunday?
Well, they certainly were not ready for the scope and scale of what was what took place. I spoke even last night to people from the IDF about it and asking about the preparations. They said, well, they were, ready at certain flashpoints, looking for, and the IDF had a presence in the north, but what they weren't prepared was for thousands of people being bussed by the Syrian government to the border and rushing across the border.
Right.
By the way, these were not the Druze, as some media reported. These were Palestinians, some of them coming from Europe and elsewhere, who came across the rushed the border, and some of them successfully getting through and even getting into Israel itself. And one was caught very late in that day in Tel Aviv. The same was true on the Lebanese border, where Hezbollah paid for them to come and bust them. But the Lebanese army resisted. You do not see any presence, by the way, in any of the pictures of UNIFIL troops, the UN, which is the troops who are supposed to be guarding the border. And as much as they stopped the infiltration of weapons, that's how they stopped the infiltration of these buses.
I didn't realize they were responsible for the Syrian border. I always associate them with Lebanon.
No, the Lebanon border.
Oh, the Lebanese border.
Lebanese border. And UNDAF in the south, the UN forces in the south also. There was no presence and no visibility of them doing anything. And, we're supposed to have the European monitors at
right.
at the Gaza crossings, and we know that every time somebody sneezes, they run away.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Lebanese border, supposedly 10 people were killed, but killed by Lebanese forces who shot at them and tried to stop them from going across the border.
All right, so this all begs the question, will it happen again?
Well, I can tell you that there are websites that are promoting it and urging people to go. And the real question is, if instead of thousands, what if tens of thousands
right.
start coming? And if this is a nightmare scenario that we have long feared, I think we discussed it here on the air. So I was reluctant because we didn't want to give them any ideas, but it seems that they got it on their own. This was, I think, mostly promoted by the Facebook communication, but certainly had the endorsement of the governments. The Egyptian forces did try to stop people going into Gaza to attend and to participate in this, but Gaza itself, of course, people came to the border closer to Israel than they have ever before. And there were some fatalities there as well. But you saw the international reaction to the fact that 14 people died was very muted. Because
right, including the United States.
People understand that a country can't allow its borders to become irrelevant and that its security be jeopardized. And, the consequences of that could be disastrous.
All right, we got to focus for a minute, and that's about all we got. On the first half of the speech, I know we've discussed this before, and the way the news works, we've discussed a lot of this before, but if we're going to talk about how unrealistic certain parts of the Israel section of President Obama's speech was yesterday, we should talk about some of the unrealistic sections of the first part with this whole Arab Spring. Doesn't it seem strange? And we've discussed, again, about how revolutions work and how there's usually, one following the other very quickly. I mean, with the Muslim Brotherhood being the front runners in Egypt, and forget all the other countries he mentioned yesterday, is it an accurate analysis to project to the world that in fact democracy is going to soon reign in a place like Egypt?
I think it's not realistic to expect that the democracy is going to flourish, and none of the signs that we see now. Our sources of great inspiration, aside from some of the young people who have demonstrated their desire for it. What we've seen in Egypt is a collapse of the society, a collapse of law and order. The political process will be changed once the elections take place, but the Muslim Brotherhood there and in other countries, being the only organized opposition during the Mubarak years, obviously is in a key position to have a very influential role. The events, people have to understand democracy is a process. You need to develop the internal infrastructure. One of the Arab leaders who talked about the reforms that he was making told us that but he sees that you need a long time. You need years to develop the parties, to educate people, to participate in the political process. How do they make decisions about how they vote? You know, people have never had it.
Right.
You can't do this overnight.
Right.
And the bottom line is that the key issue is jobs. In countries, you know, that they interview young people, 3% said it's political issues that motivates them, and 87% said jobs. And when you have 75% of the population under 25 and under 30 years of age, and there are no jobs for them, that's the key.
And you can replicate this in all the other countries.
You can replicate it everywhere. And you see that, look, in Tunisia, where it's been relatively quiet,
right?
And, you know, you've had a stalemate, and the Muslim Brotherhood has not become the dominant force, but they still don't have a government. They still don't have a solution to the post-revolution problem. Egypt is going through the throes of the aftermath, but we know that the police are not patrolling. We know that the army wants out of the positions they hold and wants to turn it over to civilian control. And you have Amri Moussa, who will be probably the next president, who's no friend for us, and El Arabi is the foreign minister.
Right.
They talk about abrogating the agreements or modifying the agreements with Israel. These are all very scary developments. And there are many other factors, with the price of food going up, with other things that are happening, and the tumult, the revolutions are still in process. These plates are still shifting. And anybody who tells you they know the outcome right now doesn't know the Middle East. Nobody knows what ultimately will come of this. And we see continuing changes. We see Iran's role continuing. You know, there was a flotilla to Bahrain,
right,
which got very little notice and got turned back. We see the rising tensions, even though Bahrain made an outreach to the Iranians. You see the split in Iran. Ahmadinejad yesterday fired three more ministers of his government. But we find out that Iran is building rocket bases in Venezuela. There are so many manifestations we could talk about just of the events of the last week, when his own religious mentor, Yazdi, criticized him for being divisive, and people who don't follow it don't see how, because the media doesn't follow it, but how deep the rifts in Iran have become between Ahmadinejad and Khamenei, and we don't know yet what the outcome of that fight will be.
Right. Okay.
They are clearly playing a role in instigating a lot of the revolutions in other places.
No question, and including, what did I read, defense missile system being set up in South America or some other type?
In Venezuela, there's rocket launchers. They're 20 meters deep. These are medium-range rockets.
And the path leads back to Iran?
These are Iranians. This is set up by the Iran Revolutionary Guard firm that owns it. They're in Paraguana, which is an island in a peninsula in Venezuela. And this is an Iranian operation. It's not for Venezuela.
Unbelievable. All right, Malcolm, thanks so much for the analysis. Have a good Shabbos. We'll speak next week.
Okay, good Shabbos.